Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we'll continue our explorations of the cultures of consciousness. You know, I say that most weeks in that kind of repetitive way that people get when they're doing podcasts and radio. It's sort of like part of the vibe. It's some regularity in the novelty. And so what do I mean by that? What are cultures of consciousness? And I think it's that you can really look at a lot of what happens in our human reality as the combination of those two things. That I don't believe, like a lot of people these days, that our minds, our experiences, our consciousness is completely constructed from culture. You know, some people will say that. Our language, the culture we grow up with, the ideas, the way we process sensory information, it's all sort of constructed, and there's really nothing left at the end, and I don't think that's the true. I don't know what consciousness is, but I think it's absurd to undermine its unique characteristic and the possibilities that there are inherent aspects of consciousness that transcend culture, that move throughout human species, and go through the history and possibly connect up with other animals. That's what I meant by species, mammals, who knows? Who knows how far it goes? And that to say that that's just some kind of construct is an incredibly limited view, and science supports us to some degree. We tend to look more with an eye towards neuroscience, understanding ourselves as biological beings, as evolved beings, so that even our fine-tuned neuroses and seemingly very specific human activities can be seen in light of the fact that we're evolved animals, and that's a one way of getting at the kind of intrinsic quality of consciousness, although again a lot of scientists are very hesitant to say that there is something specific or intrinsic to consciousness. They want to say that it's also an effect, except instead of being an effect of culture and upbringing, it's an effect of the structure of the neurons in the brain, and that it's actually kind of a ghost image of something that is much more primarily material. And again, I can't quite go there. And so what interests me is the interaction of these things, how this consciousness thing emerges, expresses itself, and interacts with culture, how culture, including scientific concepts and understandings, which I think of as being part of culture, interacts with this consciousness mystery, this ghost, this essence, the spirit, whatever it may be. And from that perspective, a lot of things become interesting, I think, in a way you start to see the connections between stuff as divergent as, you know, psychoactive culture among teenagers and high art and religion and, you know, the whole variety of expressions of creative acts, and particularly in the light of today's show, magic in all of its forms and functions. And today we'll be talking to an excellent performance magician named Ferdinando Buscema, I think I'm pronouncing it correctly, who I met at Burning Man and then later at the Boom Festival. So he's a fellow traveler on the weirdo festival circuit, and also a very, very interesting magician and what he calls himself a magic experience designer. And so we'll get to him in just a second. But before that, we'll bring on our co-host, Maja Daou, who also knows Ferdinando. Maja, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good, Eric. Thanks.
That's right. We saw Ferdinando at the Magic Castle in L.A.
That was an awesome night.
Super fun. So wait, people might not know what the Magic Castle is. Why don't you tell them?
Oh, man. So in Hollywood, it literally looks like a castle. It was an older mansion that my friend Liberty Larson's grandfather took over and turned into a place for all his magician friends to do magic performances. And it's like an insider club, but it's open to the public. So it's kind of like a magician's club / theater performance place. But you go inside and it's nuts. It's all these little rooms and there's like owls everywhere and crazy old antiques, and the whole place has all these illusions kind of set up all over it. So so the, it's literally like the magic is in the walls of the castle itself. And as a building, having magicians perform there, it's like absorbed all the juju and mojo from all of the tremendous perform. Like every magician ever has probably performed there, don't you think, Eric? Like,
oh, it's, yeah. It's,
everybody.
I mean, it's a classic.
It's like a magic vortex, really.
And it is true that the way that one of the things that's really remarkable about it as an entertainment, destination, is that you go, and even though you're just a member of the public, it's like you kind of got to like do a little bit of work to get there. It's not like just going down to, Ticketmaster and get, it's still accessible. If anybody who wants to go will find, be able to get there. But you have this kind of insider outsider thing where you kind of feel like you're actually been invited into the special magic.
It's true, and I have a good story to share really quick. They have a dress code, and if you don't follow the dress code, you get in trouble. Like you said, you have to go through some hoops, right? So I went there one evening to go see Ferdinando, actually, and I took my friend with me. I won't name any names so as not to embarrass her, but she's very attractive and Asian on top of that, so uber attractive. And she wore a very short dress with red, hot red jeans under, but you couldn't really tell they were jeans. And so the guy at the door told her, denim is not allowed. You're not allowed to wear jeans in the Magic Castle. So she had to take her jeans off there just wear this like excruciatingly short skirt into the castle. So yeah, even witches have to jump through some hoops to get in the Magic Castle.
I like that. Even witches have to jump through hoops.
Yeah.
That's a good one. Well, let's bring on Ferdinando, who's been in the Magic Castle a couple times, performed all over the place. Ferdinando, so thanks for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Hello, both of you. Thank you for having me on the show.
That's wonderful. And you're calling from Milan, right?
Yes, I am based in Milan, Italy.
Wonderful. Well, I kind of want to, jump in and ask you a little bit about that. I mean, I just understand, some things about magic culture in America, a little bit in the UK, and so I really don't even know what it looks and feels like in Europe. But before we get to that, I want to give you an opportunity to just maybe launch in explaining yourself in a broader way than just saying, oh, I'm a magician. With this phrase you use, on your website and as part of your career, as a magic experience designer, I think there's a lot going on in that phrase. Clearly, you've worked hard on that tag. So what is that? What's a magic experience designer?
Well, this is the kind of personal branding job title I'm working on for myself. I crafted for myself during the last few years. And it's not meant to be, just an aesthetic exercise in finding a cool job title, but in finding something that makes sense for me to express what kind of profession I'm doing, which a part of it, as you've said, I am a performer, I'm a magician, I feel a magician at heart, so I love performing, and it's definitely a good chunk of what I do. But at the same time, I'm also a consultant in order to create events that are, for some reasons, can be considered magical. So I see myself as a designer of magical experiences, which can be through the magic performance, but at the same time, I call a magic experience anything that is meant to be astonishing or amazing or memorable in some way. And hopefully that's something that can trigger some sort of transformation. So this is the kind of consultancy, this is the kind of take that I have on events, be them, big or small, but at the end of the day, they are meant to be something surprising, astonishing, and memorable. So this is the basic idea I'm juggling with.
Yeah, well, I love that idea, just to stay with it a little bit, on the notion of experience design. My wife, for example, is works on computer interfaces, and she used to describe her job, or her job used to be described by the people who did it, as user interface design. And the idea is that, people develop very complex computer systems that are designed to do certain things, but they don't always pay that much attention to the experience of the user.
Mm-hmm.
How do normal people interact with this complex system? And so you have to design that interface, the interface, the outside of the box, the way the iPod moves, the way you turn the wheel, all those things are elements of user interface. But nowadays, people who do that work, the same kind of work, they now prefer to call themselves user experience design. And so there's definitely been a move, I think, as we become more technological, or that our technologies are more intimately woven in with the fabric of our everyday lives, that the notion of design and the notion of experience are coming closer and closer. So that's very interesting. Mm-hmm. But you see that in particular as an opportunity for what we would call magic or astonishment or surprise.
Right.
So how do you see that? How do you see what is that extra element? What is the magic? Is it surprise?
Yes.
Is it emotion? Is it cognitive?
Well, as you've said, I would say that in the last 15 or 20 years, the concept of experience design is kind of taking shape and become more self-conscious of itself as a field. The basic premise is that whatever you create, be a user interface on the web or an object or even an interior design, whatever you design, when a customer or a client comes in contact with your creation, an experience emerges. So, and this is a very ancient idea, it's not something new, but in the last few years, this field that today we call experience design is somehow mapping what are the ingredients in order to have some sort of experience emerge from the interaction of your creation. So this is the basic, this is the general framework I'm working on, and my personal extra added touch, if you wish, is the element of magic. Because as a magician's point of view, I had the good fortune of exploring the mechanism, the psychological mechanism and the cognitive mechanism that lie at the base of an interaction that for some reason is considered astonishing or, surprising, that somehow creates a cognitive stretch. And this is the kind of extra piece that I bring to the field of that we call experience design.
One of the things that you told me when I remember very it was a very striking moment because I kind of understood something when we were talking about magic, and even the way you're talking about magic there, that magic can be seen as an aspect of the design of experiencing that leads to that has elements of surprise and astonishment. Even that kind of goes against the way I think a lot of us are sort of trained to think about magic, which is about it's all about the guy who knows how to do something you don't know how to do. It's this a very different kind of relationship. And even though I thought I was I didn't understand or pay that much attention to the art of magic, of stage magic, but I knew something about it. I thought I was kind of hip to it. And that talking with you, it just totally changed my whole perspective, because you said this thing where it's like that there's another way of looking at magic, which is that it's a ritual to engender astonishment, like the actual feeling of astonishment, which we, for some reason, we don't think about it as a feeling. If we think about desire or joy or anger or rage, those are all emotions that maybe we go see music or a theater and we have these experiences. We go, I got my anger out, I got my joy. It was hilarious. But we don't think of astonishment as this kind of primary, profound, delightful human experience. We're always like, it's not about the astonishment. It's like, how did he do that? I want to know how to do that. Oh, he knows more than I do. And it's almost like we miss what's really going on. So tell me more about that feeling of astonishment.
Mm-hmm. Well, the basic premise is that also the feeling of astonishment and like anger or joy is something that can be triggered and that can be evoked in one way or another. As a matter of fact, as a magician, our tools of the trade it's our magic tricks. So basically our performance pieces, that we like to call them effects, are basically meant as tools in order to evoke this state of astonishment. And if we focus too much on the trick itself, it's like losing sight of the bigger picture, which is meant to be the astonishing piece. It's like, the famous Zen idea of the finger pointing to the moon. If we just focus too much on the finger, we lose the beauty of the moon. So by the same token, when a magic effects work is on magic, so to speak, somehow the magic effect points beyond itself, and when it works, is meant to evoke the state of astonishment.
Well, and that's really where the kind of occult magic comes into it, because you can say, like, yes, you can do A plus B plus C, and psychologically that equals the astonishment feeling, right? But it's not that easy, and that's why a good magician is like an artist. It's like John Coltrane, you know, because anybody can get up and play a saxophone, but if you can evoke a feeling from someone, that's like the shaman sympathy magic thing. So like, you, like, for example, when I went to see you on that evening with my friend with the really short skirt, your performance was so evocative, and I mean, to the point where you could look around and everyone in the room had like goosebumps, to the point where not only had you invoked a feeling, but like a physical response from the audience, you know, of astonishment, where they could feel it in their bodies. And then, you know, conversely, we went to go see another magic act after that, which had like all the components, but the guys were just like buffoons, and not, their soul was not present in it. So, I mean, for you to say like you kind of have this formula that you follow is true, but there is this other additive, which is the magician's art, kind of yourself, that goes into it as well.
Well, so first of all, thank you for your lovely words on my act at the Magic Castle, which I was very proud of delivering. Well, as a matter of fact, I would say there is not a one-size-fits-all formula. There is not, it's not a scientific, clear-cut way of achieving the state of astonishment. And I totally agree with you that there is something that cannot be explained, and there is an element of magic into it. You know, it's a moment of alchemy when all the pieces somehow blend together in an artful way, and this is something that transcends any kind of cognitive model we can create to explain the experience.
Yeah.
And that's when, you know, the magical moment happens. But at the same time, also from, you know, from a magician point of view, as Eugene Berger, my dear friend and mentor, says, the house of magic has many rooms, and with this it means that there is somehow, there is a multiplicity of styles, of different way of, you know, dealing with magic, and also comic magic is a form of it. Even being, you know, just the trickster, the jester, can have its own function.
Mm-hmm.
So in my case, I'm especially sensitive also to the symbolic aspect of performing magic, and so this is what I'm generally very drawn towards a way of, you know, evoking this feeling of astonishment through my artful deceptions that definitely are not meant to be played. One of the things that as a magician you always risk is somehow to engage in any sort of challenge with the rational and cognitive mind of the person in front of you. And no one likes to be fooled, you know, per se, because from a magician point of view, you show something to lay people that they don't know how it works. And for this reason, if you engage with someone only on this level, that's when you ask yourself how it's done and you try to figure out the trick, because you don't like to be fooled. But when the magic works its magic, we kind of transcend this how it's done ease, and we are able to go beyond it. But it's not something that happens every time. I want to, you know, to stress this fact, that the moment when it happens, it's a magical moment also for me, and I can recognize that it's something very special happening. And as a matter of fact, exactly the night you were at the Magic Castle, the exact performance you came to see was one of the most amazing for me as well. So, you know, as a performer, you need some sort of, to create some sort of feedback loop also with your audience.
Right.
So it's not always the same every time. Every time changes. And so you can set the bar to your higher limit, but, you know, maybe you perform the same thing 10 times, and 8 times, it's, you know, it's good magic, it's an interesting, astonishing experience, and maybe a couple of times is something really special.
Mm.
And again, it's not something that can work 100% of the time in terms of, you know, evoking a higher state of astonishment, and that's why there is also an element of, you know, something that cannot be explained. It's a mysterious experience.
Well, that's
so somehow
really...
I'm
leaping in because I want to get on that idea. You said a higher state of astonishment, because there are levels of astonishment. And
yeah.
one of the games that, and I mean that in a broad way, that magic invites you into is to sort of set up and transcend these kinds of levels. So, for example, there's a lot of people, there's cognitive scientists and neuroscientists who are looking at magic because magic is a sort of heuristic techniques that have developed over thousands mm-hmm. of years that take advantage of gaps, tendencies, predilections, points.
Cognitive holes.
Yeah, cognitive holes that we have, that are partly based on our evolution. And so it's actually a really great way to look at and have some insight into what some of these functions of consciousness of the brain are. And it's interesting, I've read some of this material, and it's funny because on the one hand I love it, and on the other hand I'm often frustrated with it, because on the one hand it's like, yeah, they're seeing that there's actual cognitive value or that there's some substance to these things. They're not merely tricks. They're not merely, I know how to do something that you don't know how to do. It's that the way that they stage the unconscious parts of our perceptual processing is really remarkable and really fun. And they almost, you can see that scientists kind of enjoy, like, well, let's explain how it is that someone cannot see where the ball is or whatever the trick is. And so that's kind of, it's like they're moving into astonishment as a site of a kind of scientific understanding. But they mm-hmm. often miss those higher levels. Because those higher levels, when that mysterious magic happens, it's that the whole way in which we try to explain anything, even the explanation of why we couldn't figure out the trick, even the explanation of how the brain works so that we don't see the ball, that even that level of explanation is transcended. Maybe only for a moment. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's 5 seconds. Maybe it's mm-hmm. 10 seconds. But it's an incredibly valuable cognitive experience that we don't, as a society, we don't recognize the value of it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's like a cognitive orgasm. It's like you're out of yourself. You have nowhere to stand. And in that moment, even if you're a secular person, there's something of the spiritual, there's something of the transcendent, there's something of the encounter with the enigmatic origins of everything, and then you're just sitting in some hotel drinking a martini, and there's a funny guy in a tuxedo, but for those few seconds, you really had this kind of leap. So what do mm-hmm. you do as a performer to try to get that symbolic, deeper, almost psychedelic kind of wisdom or experience out of your performances?
Well, that's a very big issue, and it's a very big question. And definitely, I think that the overall, just to pick up about a couple of things you said, I think that, well, my feeling is that the overall scientific discourse about trying to dissect magic in order to explain its, cognitive, psychological mechanism, I think it's a very interesting piece of, field of study. But at the end of the day, I find it very, it's another way of fostering the disenchantment of the world. Because I think that it's like trying to kill someone to figure out where the soul is. I think that there is a moment of the performance where something mysterious and ineffable happens. That, again, can be for 5 seconds, for 3 seconds. But when it happens, transcends any kind of explanation. And again, whenever you're confronted a piece of art, of course we can explore the piece of art and trying to explain and figure out why it works, why it evokes an aesthetic experience. But at the end of the day, the aesthetic experience is something very direct and very primal and very immediate that transcends any, we can talk about it, we can explore the idea, we can rationalize it, but the direct first-hand experience is primal. And there is a limit, in my opinion and my point of view, to how much we can dig into this, we can explore into this in order to make sense out of it.
That's why it's so great, and I mean that description of it is so good, because the magic thing is you can explain to someone exactly how it works and exactly what you're doing, and they can know everything that's going on, and that still does not remove the mystery factor. Like the fact that through knowledge, you can find out everything there is about it, but there's still a propensity to have a primal experience. That's, like, to me, that's where the magic is living.
Mm. Well, I think that, yeah, in this sense, I see that every magical performance is a way, in some sense, to celebrate the mystery of, you know, to some minor or lesser extent, to celebrate the mystery of life itself, to celebrate the mystery of consciousness, the mysteries of language, and every time we get into this playground, mysterious things can happen if you allow them to happen, if you are kind of open to receive this kind of experience.
Mm.
And you, as a culture, as a society, we are so much accustomed to explain everything and to make sense out of everything, and we kind of assume that in the fast-paced society in which we live in, where we process information so fast, that we can explain everything. And this is not true. There is a huge share of our experience as human beings which remains a mystery, and it will remain a mystery. There is the title of a show by my friend and mentor Max Maven that you had a chance to meet yourself. The title of his show is called An Evening, Max Maven Thinking in Person, An Evening of Knowing and Not Knowing. And basically the premise of the show is that knowing is a good thing, but also not knowing is a good thing. So in a way, in an artful way, as Max Maven can deliver, he somehow invites people to celebrate and to, you know, to engage in the idea of not knowing something, because there is an aesthetic element even in not knowing something. And, you know, as a culture, we might somehow need to be a little bit more at ease with the idea of not knowing something, instead of trying to, you know, to drill into the rabbit hole, you know, all the way. Does it make sense?
Very much. You know, and you mentioned both Eugene Berger and Max Maven, both of whom we've had on the show, and both of whom were brought to my attention by you because of your description of this certain, it's hard to say, is it a school, is it a style, is it an aesthetic philosophy, but there's a certain discourse and understanding of magic in among these people, among you guys, that's very distinct, and again, I think has a lot to say to people who are interested in other kinds of topics about consciousness and spirituality and,
mm-hmm.
and meaning in the modern world. I mean, it's really the kind of it's not exactly esoteric because it's not you know specifically a cult or anything, but it has a kind of appreciation of these deeper symbolic
mm-hmm.
levels. So, just how would you characterize that school?
Well, both, you know, Eugene Berger, Max Maven, whom I consider my mentors and during the years I can call now friends, and also, for example, Jeff McBride is another very dear friend of mine. These people inside the magic community and the magic brotherhood worldwide somehow are credited with, all their work in performance and writing. They somehow helped, and this is what they are still doing nowadays, helped modern magician reframe and review and get a deeper understanding of what the art of magic, as you know, as a performing art, as conjuring, what does it mean to be a magician? What does it mean to do tricks, to you know, to trick people? Is it only, you know, nice to have fun piece of entertainment, or there is something more going on, something deeper going on in this kind of very ancient art form? And so basically, through their work, they are stimulating this renewed sensitivity to what we can call magic and meaning. And there is a very special book, which is titled itself Magic and Meaning, that somehow, I just mentioned one of them, which is a very, very influential book inside this kind of underground, that somehow for the first time tried to bring to the attention the deeper meanings, the deeper layers of meaning, of symbols, of what doing magic means. And of course this whole discourse has its own origin in shamanism. So we know that shamans, in their bag of tricks, they also performed. They were proto kind of performers. So they also did magic tricks for how we, you know, we mean them nowadays. But the goal was not only to entertain people or to fool them, but as we know, shamans had also somehow some kind of healing powers. So in order to performing their magic, their conjuring, their shows, somehow all of this was meant to enhance his own personal power, which at the end of the day was also used in a healing context. So this is just a few of the ideas that, thanks to this sensitivity, to this renewed sensitivity to magic and meaning, in the last maybe couple of decades, maybe a little bit more, this whole new generations of magicians, and myself included, have been very, very highly stimulated and heavily imprinted with this, and we basically very deeply resonated with this kind of discourse. And this is how we are, you know, each one of us in his own different way is trying to embed this kind of feeling and understanding and awareness in our own performances.
Well, this is wonderful stuff. We got a lot more to talk about. I've had a bunch of questions in my head, but we're going to take a break right now. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maj Daou. We're talking to Ferdinando Buscema about magic, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. And we're here with Mr. Eric Davis, speaking with the lovely and talented magician Ferdinando Buscema. And before the break, Ferdinando, you had mentioned about the shamanic element in magic. And I had also asked when Eugene and Max were on the show, which I'll ask you now, because I'm fascinated by this aspect. If, as a performance magician, if you personally ever experienced a kind of healing take place during one of your performances, or if you ever came across in your training anything where you discovered you might have an ability to kind of have a healing effect on someone as a result of your performance magic studies.
Well, I would say definitely yes. You know, engaging in a performance of magic, magical things can happen. And definitely you kind of expose yourself to a higher ratio of magical events happening. And I'm talking about minor or major moments of, you know, kind of smaller, quick satori, or a moment of deep intuition, or a moment of, you know, even a moment of transcendence.
Mm.
So you definitely expose yourself to a higher ratio of a numinous kind of experience. This is definitely happening, yes.
Because it's like a lot of people don't think that might happen, but what I think is amazing is that some magicians, whether they kind of like it or not, when they're opening themselves to that, they do actually take on some shamanic properties themselves. By doing this ritual activity, you kind of become charged with it yourself, you know? And I think the conscious magician that is paying attention and kind of directing it with intentionality, you guys can really, like, formulate a lot of that. Whereas other magicians, I think it kind of happens maybe on accident sometimes, and then,
mm-hmm.
you know, I mean, I think it happens accidentally to everybody all the time, because it kind of sneaks in there. If you're blown wide open. But Eugene had related a story of how he healed a woman's dog. This woman had come up to him after a performance and just asked him, you know, what he could do for her dog that was sick. And sure mm-hmm. enough, he, you know, put his hands on the dog and really helped it out. And I think that's just as a result of his engaging in the ritualistic practices.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I remember very well the story you're mentioning. And yes, I agree that, you know, even playing and conjuring with symbols, symbols are somehow entities, though abstract, are somehow living entities in their own, you know, in their own way. And so if you think also, if we think about even religious symbols, are very much loaded with meaning by the people who, you know, who believe in them. And just think about the cross. For many millions of people, it's still a very powerful symbol that can trigger very real reactions, very real emotions. So somehow juggling and playing and conjuring with symbols, somehow I think that activates some sort of subtle energies that can manifest themselves in reality and have some sort of concrete and very practical impact on the consciousness, on the psyche of the people experiencing this kind of performing ritual. And of course, also, you know, from the standpoint of the person who is somehow guiding the ritual itself.
Well, I'm curious, in terms of these issues, how much you've been sort of influenced or opened up by your experiences with festival culture. I mean, that's where we met in the context of Burning Man and then later at Boom, and clearly that's been sort of a part of your cultural life, is to go to these festivals and sort of absorb the energy. And indeed, they're often very magical places. They're liminal places. People leave their ordinary mind frames behind. There's more room for synchronicity. There's more room for just a sense of astonishment, of marvel.
Well, yes, it's, of course, it's been great to meet at Burning Man in that very special and liminal space. And yes, I think that globally, this kind of archaic revival of festivals, of collective joys, events, that are, you know, these are liminal spaces where good magic happens, and again happens by itself, just creating a space that's creating a context that somehow welcomes magic, and somehow, you go in a place that somehow it's designed to, you know, to be a magical space. And I definitely, whenever I go into this kind of festivals, you know, bigger or smaller events, I think that on the average, the people who are somehow drawn towards these events, I would say that on the average, they are more in touch and more in contact with the concept of astonishment and wonder. They are very much more open to this experience, to these feelings. And somehow in these places, I see that there people go there and try to recharge themselves with enchantment, with somehow in order to go back to the ordinary life, so to speak, and bring back a piece of enchantment in a disenchanted world. And I think that this kind of global phenomenon that in the last few decades is kind of taking shape is becoming more and more conscious. And also places like Boom Festival, which is another pretty amazing experience, these places are kind of incubators for also social experiments, social design experiments, where people are come together for some time and somehow can survive peacefully, joyfully, having fun, and somehow being sustainable. So in some sense, in these places, I see them as incubators for possible new lifestyles and new ways of living that can be somehow, it's not always an easy game to play, but somehow can be brought back to the more ordinary life and making it a little bit more enchanted.
So now, what way can you imagine to really kind of imagine magic in a different situation or in a new environment? Like how performance magic, how the kinds of rituals and performative skills that you've developed, how might that play a role in this kind of groundswell of cultural change that we can all feel despite all of the difficulties? I mean, most people think of magic as just a kind of corny fun thing. It's like we associate it with Vegas, maybe a little bit more sophisticated. We think we associate it with a certain kind of rigorous atheism like Penn Jillette kind of puts forward, where it's like it's used as an intense tool of disenchantment, of almost kind of sardonic tearing down of things, so that's a very different flavor that has some cultural power, clearly. But I feel like there's still more a larger role that magic could play in this kind of whatever you want to call it, creative redemptive culture, the sort of culture of consciousness that that we see around us as well. So just putting on your like a visionary hat, like how could you see a broader, richer role for the kinds of performative experiences that you're talking about in in this work of cultural regeneration?
Well, I think that magic is a very rich memeplex where somehow part of the discourse of magic can be, you know, rationalized, magic being the art of possibility. So in the realm of magic, everything is possible. And so whenever we process and we kind of use this kind of magic software in our mind, we're somehow invited to play with the idea of possibilities, that maybe there is something that meets the eye, maybe there is something that it's not been yet discovered, but this, or yet been seen, but even if it's something that you've not yet experienced, it doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. It's that maybe your antenna is not yet, you know, tuned on the right wavelength, so to speak. And so I think that magic as a, you know, as a framework is a way of addressing the idea that there are more possibilities that we generally acknowledge, and the very first tool, I would say the very basic tool of a magician, is imagination. And imagination is that, I would say that we can call it a very specific human ability that can help you navigate in the realm of possibilities. So everything that surrounds us takes shape, before taking shape in reality, takes shape in the realm of imagination. And at the moment we can conceive a new idea, a new thought, that's the first starting point, that's the seed that hopefully, if properly nourished, will blossom into something new, into a new possibility taking shape. But the first piece of this puzzle starts in the realm of imagination. And also from, you know, if we go back to even Renaissance magicians like Giordano Bruno or other Renaissance magicians, imagination has been, for, you know, throughout all their writings, has been the paramount tool of the magician in order to, you know, to navigate in the different levels of reality.
Well, let's stay on the topic of imagination. I know you also do, you know, corporate seminars, and you do work that has a kind of what would you call it? You know, self-actualization quality to it. But most, you know, a lot of this stuff I find very kind of weird. But the metaphor of magic works for me as a way to understand some of those things. But when I think about imagination, I think one of the challenges that people have now is precisely because there's so much information, there's so much incoming data, there's so many films and TVs, and we have comics downloaded on the phones that we take. You know, we're surrounded by this input that, you know, which has a certain relationship to the imagination. It requires imagination to make the stuff up in the first place. It stimulates our imagination. In some ways, we feed imaginally off of, you know, works of art and especially fantasy and science fiction, and it's no accident that those genres are so popular, because they give us something that we need, something about that enchanted world or that world of wonder. But it also seems like people often feel somewhat cut off from my own sources of imagination. I think one of the reasons people like festival culture and even like psychedelics is because they just provide a sort of immediate encounter with the work of the imagination, influenced by, but in some ways freed up from, this sort of matrix of, you know, technological culture and its transmission of images and ideas. So how do you, taking this idea that imagination is a crucial starting point towards this world of possibility, how do you encourage people to sort of come, you know, to open up their own imagination, or to stimulate it, to work with it, to nurture it, to get to know it?
Well, as you said, a good share of my work happens on the corporate playground, where the idea of imagination can be translated into a process of innovation from the point of view of a company or a corporation. Whatever you produce, or be it a good or a service, the ongoing process of innovation is recognized as a very key factor in order to have your own corporation, whatever its size, in, you know, make it keep on being profitable and sustainable at the same time, and hopefully making some sort of good for the rest of the planet. So the idea of using the metaphor, the structure, the narrative framework of magic is a very rich language in order to trigger and stimulate the idea of imagination, that everything is possible. Well, everything is possible when you know how to do it, which can sound like, you know, like a tautologic kind of idea, but this is the point. I've been very much inspired, and I've been very much imprinted by your own book, Technosis, which for the first time allowed me to craft my own point of view of how magic and technology are very deeply linked and very deeply connected. So, you know, the very famous and over-quoted quote by Arthur Clarke, any sufficiently advanced technology is virtually indistinguishable from magic. So this is the point. If we reframe the idea of magic as a technology, we get some sort of extra insight of how magic can work. So magic has its own laws, its own structure that can be somehow harnessed for the good of mankind and for the good of people who want to play with it. So in my own corporate world, I can somehow guide people and stimulate them and somehow facilitate a process where imagination can be somehow stimulated and hopefully can bring some sort of gifts. But this is the point. I think that even in the very highly complex, you know, cultural moment in which we live in, imagination itself maybe is kind of getting to its next level of complexity, if you wish. And it's something that can be trained, can be stimulated. And nowadays we have so many pieces to juggle with, we have so many means, that the idea of imagination itself is really kind of pushing the boundaries of what we mean by imagination. And for example, of course, the idea of imagination is very much linked to the idea of creativity. Somehow are not, you know, are intertwined concepts. And in this sense, one of the most recent ideas that I, well, one of the most recent narratives that I came up with, that I discovered, is the idea of creativity seen as a combinatory ability. So the idea that basically it's very much difficult to invent something completely new, but taking pieces or means that are already existing and combining them in new forms and shapes and, you know, formats that can bring to the emergence of new properties that are somehow, you know, can be newer novelty, and we can create something that didn't exist before.
Yeah, what's interesting is that that's also just part of the way the imagination works. I mean, if you look at some of the classical accounts of the imagination and people trying to figure out what's genuinely novel in imagination and what's maybe more just recombinant. And you know, like when Coleridge wrote about the imagination, he would think about it in terms of its ability to combine different elements into novel syntheses. And you can even look at, like, you know, the world of monsters, you know, in our heads. We all have monsters. You know, we've seen them. We grew up with them. There's the werewolf. There's the griffin. There's Frankenstein. Mm-hmm. There's Dracula. And you can look at a lot of these monsters and you see, well, you know, do they exist? Do they not exist? What does that mean? One thing I can say is that they're combinations, very productive, very creative combinations of different things, like a wolf and a man. But somehow bringing those things together, something new is released, at least into the imagination, a kind of cultural idea, a myth, a power. But I think that what you're saying is that right now there are so many ways and means to recombine that we have the opportunity to sort of, you know, fine-tune that process and really kind of jumpstart the imagination in a way because of all the combinatory possibilities that exist in our culture now.
Well, that's what evolution is, really. I mean, evolution happens when DNA recombines. So we're doing imaginationally something that biologically happens in the world. And that's really kind of what the magician is, right? When you can drive an evolutionary biological process in nature through your consciousness. And I think a lot of, Ferdinando, what you were saying is so important with designing those experiences, like especially in the corporate world, you as a magician designing these experiences of pushing people's consciousness to evolve, you are creating a space that's opening the ability for like their consciousness DNA to recombine by showing them that, hey, look, you could think this way, or your imagination could go here. So essentially you're providing like a mechanism for them to do it.
Right, which is exactly a very beautiful synthesis of what I mean by magic experience design, which the performance side of it as a conjurer is just a piece of it. It's very often present because it's part of the fun as well, but it's not always strictly necessary. And that's why I mean talking about the creation of a magical space where people can experience and stretch their own imagination, this is exactly the core of what I'm called to do. And as in any good magician magic performance, the result is not 100% guaranteed. As you know, remember we've been talking about that some performances can allow you to have higher states of astonishment. By the same token, I do my best to design the best magic experience given some sort of context, and then that's the moment where the alchemy happens. If all the pieces and all the ingredients and also where the planets are properly, you know, set, then the magic experience can happen.
So what's next? What's your are you designing new performances that are coming out with? Or are you working on books? What are you doing with your with this lively approach to magic and creativity?
Well, the last project that is going on that I'm working on for the last, and will keep me busy for a few months, it will be the organization of a TEDx event. You know, the TED format, technology, entertainment, and design, and the TEDx is the local format that anyone can organize. And I'm working on one of this TEDx event that will take place in Milan, here in Italy, for next year, and meant to be quite a big and important event, and that's why it will take a few months of work. And I'm also working on this project with the support of an American foundation, which is called the Fetzer Institute, which I've been honored to be invited to be an advisor for them. And so with the support of this foundation, it's a philanthropic foundation, we are designing this experience, which is meant to be a magical experience. So, of course, many people know this, the TED format or the TEDx, and which is this beautiful lineup of beautiful and quick talks, which then are uploaded online. But also, there is also the live experience, which, you know, when you watch just a TEDx event or a TED talk, you just watch the talk, but you lose, you know, the physical live experience. So that's where my creative juices are channeled at this moment, this TEDx event here in Milan.
Well, that's good. I really hope that people start playing with the TEDx format, too. I mean, it's just such an interesting, you know, it's very powerful. A lot of people, it draws a lot of attention. And, you know, at the same time, it's like there's still some room to play with the performative aspects of that. So that sounds really wonderful. We just have, a couple minutes left here, and I just want to also just kind of out of the blue, what's a book that really inspired you, like a book about that sort of touches on some of the topics that we've done? I mean, I know you have a really good library, like a lot of magicians, so what's something that you might suggest for listeners?
Well, as I said, Technosis has been on top of my shelf for years, and I get back to it, you know, now and then. And, well, it's different to pick up books. Maybe I can name a few authors that I've been very much inspired by, like Terence McKenna or Robert Anton Wilson, Alan Watts, Timothy Leary, or, you know, all these people. Or, for example, Carl Jung, I also explored some chaos magic or Alan Moore's work. Which,
yeah.
You know, he's been a guest for a few weeks ago. And also a very interesting book I just came across recently. It's called As If. And the subtitle of the book is Modern Enchantment and the Literary Prehistory of Virtual Reality. And the author is called Michael Saller, and he teaches at in a college in California. And basically, you know, I'm very much interested in how narratives can, as a literary form, how narrative can shape reality and affect mind very deeply. Somehow, how narrative can create an imaginary space that people want to inhabit, and people want to get back to it.
Well,
well,
we're going to have to end it there, Ferdinando. So
okay.
Thanks so much for being on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Absolutely. And I just want to let people know we actually did have Michael Saller on the show, and you can access our archives on prn.fm. All right. From me and Maj Tali out there,
bye.
Keep your minds open.